Hello, everyone. Welcome to this podcast event. My name is Greg Fontes, and I run the Retention Services Division at Proactive Talent. My duties include overseeing our DEI services, learning and development services, as well as our coaching and advisory services. What you are about to hear is a panel discussion entitled Building an Authentic and Scalable DEI Strategy, and it begins right after this message.
Proactive Talent is the leading power partner to your recruiting engine. We're a coalition of recruiting and talent brand practitioners who provide the necessary tools and talent to tighten your hiring gaps, bolster your retention rates, and embolden your company mission, giving you the competitive edge needed in the ever-changing recruiting industry. With a holistic approach, we work alongside clients to help them build a powerful recruiting engine that enables them to efficiently attract, recruit, and retain top talent. We specialize in adding power to your full candidate journey from talent attraction to hiring to retention. Our clients include enterprise companies like Uber Postmates, Siemens Energy, Boston Consulting Group, Basic American Foods, and GoDaddy, as well as fast-growing startups like Calendly, Discord, and Gong. Please reach out to us today. We would love to have a conversation. You may contact us at www.proactivetalent.com. That's www.proactivetalent.com.
Let's go ahead and please introduce yourself. Marissa, we'll start with you, and then Seema, you'll follow.
Sure. Thanks, Greg. Hi, everyone. My name is Marissa Huang. I'm currently the head of talent at Playground Global. We're an early stage investment firm that focuses on deep tech and life sciences companies, ranging from automation and AI, next generation compute, and consumer and enterprise products, really focused on both the hardware and software side. Before Playground, I led the talent function at Niantic Labs. I grew the team from 70 to 700 employees. My experience includes exec search, managing talent teams and people ops at various companies, Asana, Facebook, Google. And I was also the first head of talent at Thumbtack and Figma.
Great. Thank you so much. Seema?
Hi, everyone. Really excited to be here. My name is Seema Darianani, and I'm currently the Global Lead Diversity Business Partner at Google. And prior to that, I was running DEI at a SaaS company called Anaplan, and also heading the women's ERG. I've also spent quite a bit of time, about 15 years, working with survivors of human trafficking and modern day slavery, fighting gender exclusion, casteism, and colorism, and the innate need to belong. And so my focus definitely lies on understanding how the trauma of social injustice impacts our underrepresented groups' capacity to show up authentically at work.
Thanks so much, Seema. I am so excited to be having this conversation on today with both of you. You all bring incredible experience, and I know that your experience, your passion is going to bleed through as we dive into an incredible and critical topic for today on building an authentic and scalable DEI strategy. I don't know about you, but we recognize that for the last year and a half, a little bit more than that, many companies and organizations have really been trying to turn their attention more intentionally as it relates to DEI. There's been a lot of incidents within our national setting, within organizations, and organizations are really trying to figure out how do we build a DEI strategy that is sustainable, authentic, scalable? And so that's what we're going to be focusing on today. And I am incredibly excited to just dive into this conversation with you all. So with that being said, how about we begin? So the first question I want to pose, and Marissa, I want to see if you can take on this one first, but what does DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, mean to you in the context of building an organization?
Yeah, so in my experience at various startups, it really means providing the right conditions for everyone to thrive and succeed in the ways that work for them. So that's the key, is like in ways that work for them. So this means really actively ensuring that we're providing opportunities for folks from underrepresented groups without ulterior motives or tokenistic attitudes to diversity. We also really need to actively remove barriers and just kind of create the conditions for every person to have that same outcome. It's really about just kind of helping people feel valued, heard, included, respected, just all very important things to really thrive in an organization.
No, that's incredible. I love the perspective of being able to provide the right conditions for individuals that's best for them, because that requires an organization, that requires leaders to really operate in a sense of humility and really in a sense of not being so self-centered, rather being people-centered, really being people-focused, really taking in consideration their identities, their particularities, their experiences, both life as well as professional. All of those things are taken into consideration as we develop those right conditions, right? And it's specific to an organization, right? No organization has the same type of experiences or is going to build a same type of culture. Rather, these organizations are going to build an environment that has those values of inclusion, values of belonging, regardless of the type of situation that they're in. So love that perspective that you brought to the table. Seema, what about you? You have any thoughts?
Yeah, definitely. Similarly to what Marissa said, at Google, you know, we define equity by equally high outcomes of access, opportunities, and success for all individuals, regardless of any social or cultural factors. So I think it's definitely important to center on that and basically to really try hard to make sure that equity is a huge focus in everything that we do.
Love it. I love the emphasis on equity, because sometimes we can forget about that, right? We can forget about that. We can focus on other aspects of DEI, but then when we get down to the nitty gritty, sometimes equity can be, you know, pushed by the wayside. And so having that intentionality towards that, I think is awesome. And so with that being said, and this is a question for either of you, where you can both either come jump in on this one. Where do you think organizations are getting their approach right in the sense of DEI and developing a DEI strategy? And where do you see and think organizations are doing it wrong?
I can jump in on that, Greg. So, I mean, as you mentioned, like those last couple of years have definitely been quite difficult. So I'm not going to say that there are organizations that are doing it perfectly. And, you know, we all definitely have quite a bit of work to do. I don't think anyone has it right per se, but so I'm going to focus on maybe two things that I see that are going wrong and then follow it up with two things that I see that organizations are doing, doing right. So one, I think hiring a CDO and expecting them to fix everything without giving them a budget, headcount, you know, correct reporting structure, essentially hiring someone as the face of DEI is probably not the right move. And then secondly, kind of ignoring data. You know, data is going to guide us and help measure what we're doing right and wrong. And it's something that comes to mind for me is the exit interview. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think we should still do these, but imagine if we conducted these interviews and gathered similar feedback while the employees are still with the company and then implement that feedback or changes that are requested to make them, you know, have a better experience. So, I mean, those two things are things that I think that, you know, everyone can work on. And then what we're getting right is, you know, I think that it's unfortunate that many opened their eyes to racial injustice during the pandemic when, you know, so many of us have been facing racism for since we were born. It's definitely helped companies, though, to stop and think and focus less on performative allyship and really dig deep into how they can foster a culture of inclusion and belonging. So while, you know, the last few years have been very difficult, I think the fact that we were in this pandemic really kind of helped people focus. Another thing that I think is going right is for the companies that are not only focusing on hiring externally, but retaining and promoting the talent you have within. especially your underrepresented groups.
That's great, Seema. Like, I totally agree in terms of the silver lining of all of this would be that we're sort of moving beyond that performative allyship. I think that, you know, with everything that's happened and things that people have faced, you know, every day of their lives, but now that's getting a lot more attention, I think people have noticed that, okay, like some of the things that we've done in the past have really caused, you know, discomfort in the very least or harm to underrepresented groups. And they're really in a hurry to kind of make amends and kind of try to make that experience better. And while this, I would say kind of like, while this urgency on DEI is really needed, it has given rise to a couple of problems. So I totally agree with you on the kind of single person ownership. It's really hard. Like if we really want DEI initiatives to be successful, it really involves everyone at the organization. So this starts at the top. Like senior leaders really have to do more than just provide the budget if they want to drive real change. So instead, like they need to be modeling behaviors. They need to look inward at their own biases, cultivate that honest, you know, honest conversations, trust, transparency. That's really going to, you know, help them and kind of help them build DEI into the core of their strategy. So I think like that's a big thing for me is that if you can empower people to speak up when they notice something's not right, and just be open to learning and changing, that's like a big area. So kind of thinking about how to not just put it all on one person, because that's not only just a lot, but it's like infeasible. The other kind of thing I'm thinking about that Greg, you talked about is kind of that one size fits all, right? Like I would say most of us recognize like no two organizations have exactly the same diversity climate. So why would we kind of come up with exactly the same solutions or processes to help improve DEI? So guidelines, workshops, playbooks, that all is super helpful, but it's really up to leaders to get to know their organization's DEI strengths and kind of blind spots just on a more deeper level. So they can really propose solutions, right? That are more specific, they're intentional, they're thoughtful. I have so many, but I'm going to try to keep it deep and brief. The last thing that, you know, some people might find controversial, but really is around the business case for DEI. So I just feel like, you know, there's one of the more problematic constructs, like kind of underpinning DEI as a whole, is that we often want to back it up with a ton of stats around like how it positively impacts productivity, performance, profit, all of this stuff. But a lot of these stats they're super compelling. But I just feel like that thinking sets a wrong intention. Like we really need to think of it as central to our strategy because it's the right thing to do, not because it's just like a numbers game. So those are kind of like the three areas that I really feel like need to change, or we need to think of ways to kind of improve it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. And so as both of you were talking, you know, one of the themes that I've sort of heard from both of you was this idea of performative allyship, right? Performative DEI. How does an organization, or how do we know when an organization is not operating in performative DEI? Like, how do we determine that? Who's the determinant of that? Because I've worked along with different organizations who in a consulting capacity where they've been doing things, but certain employees still would categorize that as being performative. Whether it's hiring practices, whether it's funding that has gone into different departments and for different roles and positions and whatever have you, so on and so forth. So how do we know when an organization has sort of transitioned beyond the performative allyship, performative DEI, into the actual relevancy of the organization, really being an organization that is socially conscious and aware? Like how do we know that distinguishment?
You know, I think that we saw this quite a bit with the racial injustice, and we would see that companies were posting stuff, you know, on Instagram and LinkedIn and making statements, right? And often I would, you know, talk to, because I work with quite a few people across the industry, and I talk to people, and some people would say, you know what, no one talked to the Black folks in the company before putting that statement out. You know, no one checked in on how we were really feeling before saying, yes, you know, Black Lives Matter. We support all, you know, our employees, et cetera. I think how we know that's truly changed is when leadership has that relationship with all their underrepresented groups and are able to make that decision collectively. And sure, if you want to post something, go ahead. But it's not like you're posting something without checking in with your actual team, because then it's completely performative. And, you know, similar to what Marissa was saying before, it's like without leadership's buy-in and without them really leading by example, we're not going to make any changes. It has to, DEI has to be the foundation of what everyone does, not just the DEI team, right? So, I mean, I think it would be great to eventually work myself out of a job where everyone is doing my work in their role. So, so that's where I would think that it would be genuine at that point.
Mm-hmm. Got it. What about you, Marissa?
Yeah, I totally agree with everything that Seema has mentioned. I would say that like a good, I think it's Verna Myers who puts it really well, like diversity is being invited to the party, but inclusion is being asked to dance, right? So it's all about that. Like you can post, you can put whatever you want on there, and that is sort of performative, but like, how are you actually thinking about like, how are we gonna ask these people to dance and be a part of this? And there's so many things that are already so, you know, unfair and unequal, and kind of figuring out like, how can we level the playing field for folks in a way that's thoughtful and includes everyone's voices, right? Don't build a DEI strategy for people of color and forget to ask people of color like what they think. Like that's just, it happens so often that it gave me that real cringe factor, but it's something that people don't think about. And so that needs to change for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Both of those things resonate with me. Both of them do. And it's leading me to this next question that I want to pose and suggest is, you know, as we're moving away from this, or hoping that we move away from this performative idea of DEI, what are some of the ways that we can start a DEI program? What are some of the three steps to take to build the best program? How do we build that program that's not performative? Marissa, do you want to start off with that?
Yeah, I feel like Seema has built many more programs than I have, and I've just, you know, been a contributor and onlooker. But I think one of the first things to do is like really identify where you are as an organization, right? So each company has its own specific diversity climate that we talked about. Focusing on what your company needs instead of what other companies have already done is like super critical. So you can hold focus groups, you can encourage people to share stories, look at your own unconscious biases. There's a lot to learn from one another, right? To just kind of encourage that honest conversation and really make that safe space, because psychological safety is like a big component of that. You can, you know, a lot of people send out engagement surveys or an anonymous survey to just kind of identify like certain blind spots or gaps in your processes and employee experiences, because that can differ very widely, even depending on department or folks within a department. And so a lot of these approaches will really surface the key issues that different underrepresented folks experience on a day-to-day basis. It's really important to note that, you know, these all require that psychological safety, the culture of trust, open communication. Without that, you really need to start there first and really kind of think like, how are we gonna get there? And then another big part that's been mentioned around like metrics and kind of, just is measuring and evaluating from the very beginning. So you really need to understand where you are on your journey before proposing different solutions and changes. And you can really only understand your progress and evolve if you're tracking it, right? So use these conversations and the quantitative and qualitative data you've collected to set realistic goals, and then find ways to measure those that encompass more than just a headcount or a bottom line. And then kind of the third kind of main component is sort of acting and evolving kind of your strategy, right, as you're building out this program. So obviously understanding and empathy are super critical. You have to have those, but acting, you know, drives change. So it's great to implement new policies and really take steps to ensure underrepresented groups are included. But part of your readiness to move the needle is really your willingness to take responsibility and accountability when things aren't working. So think about like, what's not working? It could mean really confronting aspects of your company policies that hinder your ability to create that diverse, equitable, and inclusive experience for your team.
Oh, I love that. I love that response. That was just incredible. And what really resonates me was one of the last things you just said is how taking accountability when things aren't working well. I think that's one of the things that is so important for organizations to realize that they may not have been doing DEI well. And I think that we need to sit with that. And I think we need to acknowledge that, because when we acknowledge that, that brings about a level, a sense of healing for many employees and individuals that work there. It brings a level of clarity and honesty, and it brings a new level of focus of, okay, we recognize we haven't been doing things well. Now, where do we want to go? And so I love the fact of having accountability when things aren't going well. Seema, what about you? What are your thoughts in regards to some of the steps you can take to build the best program as it relates to DEI?
Absolutely. Yes, of course. So, you know, I've done it at a company where I was pioneering it, and then obviously at a company where it's a little more established. But when you're building it, I think it's really important to focus on values. You know, it's whether it's the leadership team getting together, like what's important to you? Why are you doing this? Because if you don't have a why and you don't have something driving you, you can't continue, because this is a long, you know, this is a long haul that we have to go through. And so it's really important to identify your why. You know, Marissa mentioned data. That is equally important. You want to know where you start. It's hard to track, obviously, when people don't feel the psychological safety to self-ID. I think it's important to make sure that you're really focusing on why there isn't psychological safety and what you can do to help people self-ID so that you can get the proper metrics, you know, and then really kind of pick a few commitments that you want to stick to and that you're able to report on. You know, like you said, Greg, what are we doing wrong? You know, if you don't know what you're doing in the first place, then you can't report on that either. So, you know, what do we want to focus on? Do we want to focus on increasing underrepresented representation, or do we want to focus on hiring, retention, promotions? Whatever it is that you want to do and where you are in terms of, you know, the general kind of place you are in a company. I think it's kind of hard sometimes when people don't have budget and things like that. So definitely if you're starting off, don't boil the ocean. Pick, like, even if it's one thing that you want to do right, do it right. If you do have, you know, enough resources to focus on many things, I again would focus on, you know, representation challenges, you know, creating a stronger sense of inclusion and belonging, and measuring that through employee engagement surveys, and really also understanding where you are in terms of education. Like, where is everyone on their journey, and what kind of anti-racism, you know, educational programs do you need on a global scale for that would appeal to everyone and that would help everyone get there on their journey?
That's good. Having an understanding of where people are in their journey, because everyone comes in from different perspectives, different age, geographical locations, different educational achievements. Everyone comes in at a different place in their journey. And so having an understanding of where people are is critical, because that then increases the understanding across, it actually increases the level of cultural competence that you have, because you understand someone else. So I love what you
100%.
Are saying. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the big things that, and I think it's really the elephant in the room or the challenge that many of us are facing, is we're talking all about creating environments of psychological safety, creating inclusive environments, understanding each other, holding each other accountable, employee engagement surveys, having an understanding of where people are. All of that's great. But here's the question I want to pose to you all, the elephant in the room. How do we do that in a virtual space? How do we do that, right? Everyone's working from home. We have kids at home. We have the city coming to cut trees down in our neighborhood. We have so many things happening going on in our environments. How do we do that? Because it's so easy for us in the virtual space to turn off our cameras. It's so easy for us to just phone in. It's so easy for us to be distracted by other things and to not be as engaged. We may love working at home, but it's still a challenge. So how do we create an inclusive environment? How do we drive DEI in a virtual environment? How do we do that? Marissa, what do you think? How do we do this?
Wishing you all the answers, but I think, you know, a lot of the kind of what you would say is like very basic, right? Like showing empathy and understanding is like a big aspect of it. You know, everyone's having super different experiences from working from home. And Greg, I love how I'm in the basement because the city is chopping down trees on my street. So everybody has something come up, and and in those things that come up, you'll have a very likely different set of needs that you need to think about. So like parents and caregivers, for example, they may need more understanding around their workload or their deadline and life needs. Introverted people may be really struggling to feel heard in these virtual environments. Extroverted folks may be struggling from the lack of social connections. So really listening and understanding these experiences and really just like very simply asking about needs will help employees feel heard and just acknowledged. And then kind of along that same vein is empowering employees to own their work and routines. So this involves, again, the trust word. Trust is a huge element of building inclusion in general. And employees really have to feel trusted to work remotely in the way that works best for them. So if that means, you know, working at 6 a.m. while there are baby naps or attending fewer meetings, if they're like really having a tough time with mental health that day or that month, that's really empowering them to make those choices without fear of those negative consequences. So that's a huge first step in terms of driving inclusion. And then, you know, as leaders, like we need to visibly model these behaviors and set our own boundaries too. So, you know, you can and should reinforce this in company meetings. You maybe block out your calendar, send an email just to say, hey, I need to take a mental health day. Or, hey, I'm going to go for a hike because I've had a rough day. And just letting your employees know. And I think the more that leaders do this, they sort of are doing that role model, like parents' role model for kids, right? That it's okay to not feel 100% every single day. So those are a couple, but I think that, you know, well, I'm sure that Seema has tons of other ideas as well.
No, Marissa, you're so right. I mean, you have to focus on being flexible, leading with kindness and understanding. Everything you said is spot on. I mean, I'll have to share that, you know, I have two little girls at home, and in the beginning of the pandemic, I would constantly apologize and often put myself on mute. Like every second, it's a habit that I have, like every minute I stop talking, I put myself on mute. And then of course you have that whole, oh, you're on mute, you're still talking, you're on mute. And I was just always just so nervous. And my kids are little, so they do make noise, they fight, and you know, they do a lot of things. And one day one of my leaders was like, you know what, bring them on camera. Like, stop apologizing, bring them on camera. We want to meet them. You know, it seems like we're all going to be doing this for a while, and let's just, you know, let's just stop apologizing and bring them in. And when he said that to me, that changed so much for me, because I would just always kind of be very anxious. And, you know, like you said, Marissa, turn off your camera. I mean, it's important that we avoid judgment when someone's camera is off, because we don't know what they're doing or why they're muted quite a bit. You know, until we see our leaders, you know, lead by example with this, it's hard for us to really show who we are when we're dealing with something like this. Another thing I think that's important too is, you know, if you have things like all hands or multiple team meetings, you know, not to expect everyone to show up at that time, you know, or hold multiple meetings where it can be flexible for people who are on different time zones or people who just can't work at that time or taking kids to school or just doing something else. You know, spend more time pausing in meetings to make sure that people have a time to speak and respond. You know, that there's a lot of discomfort in pausing. And someone was telling me that I think 10 seconds is the right time to pause to let people chime in. And it seems like an eternity. but I think that's important to do. And I think in some ways, this physical distance is helping us realize that we need to find other ways to connect. So as Marissa mentioned, like when leaders need to just check in on their team and see what their needs are and then anticipate that.
One thing you brought up, Seema, that was really kind of important too, is just around the times for Zoom meetings. I feel like a lot of times, like, you know, companies may go the other way. They're like, oh, everybody is working remotely. We need to bring people together. So you know, they might do more all hands, or they might do, you know, kind of like Zoom social hours, but they could be after hours, or they could be weird times of the day or not fit even for regular meetings. Right. And then it's kind of like awkward if you don't go. It's just, it doesn't, I think there should be a lot more intentionality and thoughtfulness around that, of like the number of meetings, but also like when they are and who's included and how to kind of accommodate everybody as best as possible. And if you can't, yeah, go, absolutely, it's totally okay. And just saying that.
Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And there, when people would have a social hour, I'd be like, oh my God, I can't do this right now. The kids are home. I've got to make dinner. I've got to do this. But then there's people who are really craving attention who don't have their family at home. And so I think you're right when you say that you've got to kind of be intentional about what you're doing, because there are times where people are really craving that connection too.
I've loved this part of the conversation, because as both of you were talking, you know, one of the things that just came to mind for me is the fact that the pandemic, working remotely, has really shown us that all of us have multiple identities. We have intersections of identities, and they came out during this pandemic. You know, for me, for example, you know, during this pandemic, my daughter was born. And so for me, I've showed up to a Zoom meeting. I've showed up with the baby carrier, my baby girl's in there, and I have a bottle and I'm feeding her in the midst of this meeting, because that's just who I am, right? I can't separate the fact that I'm a DEI practitioner as well as a dad, as well as a partner to my, you know, partner. I cannot negate those things. That's who I am. And I think the pandemic showed that. And I think that when our organizations really begin to embrace the holistic person, they begin to embrace the person beyond the one making you money, the one leading your team, the one who's just responsible for one functional area. When we begin to understand that, that's when we get to a place of cultural relevance. That's when we get to the place of cultural awareness and consciousness, because we actually care about the whole being. You know, we talk about, you know, the people operations within an organization, the human operations. Well, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm being a person where you can see the full extent of my identity. So I think when we talk about doing this in a virtual space, that's when we're able to really see the full person because of all of the identities that exist. And so I love where this part of the conversation has gone. So with that being said, I want to just backtrack just for a little bit, because one of the things that we did talk about was establishing metrics. Okay. We talked about establishing metrics to help us really create that environment of where our DEI strategy is sustainable, it's actionable, and what have you. So Seema, I have a question. Let's start with you. But what are some of the metrics that are best to utilize in order to track the success of DEI initiatives?
Yeah, sure. So I think first and foremost, representation, right? And this is where that self-ID thing comes in, where you want to see where you're at first, and so that you can focus on whether you need to work on psychological safety, which I'm sure you do, by seeing, you know, what's showing up in the numbers in terms of representation. After that, I think you know, tracking hiring of underrepresented groups is important. Seeing what progression looks like for underrepresented groups versus, you know, everyone else, right? How is that going? Like, does it take longer to get promoted? Are people being paid less? You know, this is the only thing that you can look at to really kind of see the truth, right? And it can be very hard to look at, but it's important. And then retention, you know, where are people going? Why are they leaving? You know, what are the reasons that they're giving that qualitative data from exit interviews? If they're going to different teams, you know, oftentimes, I believe one of you mentioned this too. It's like HR, people ops, DEI, this is kind of a safe space for a lot of people. Like this is where you see that representation. But we don't always have to be here, right? And we should be understanding why do people want to go to people ops if, you know, it's because they see themselves, you know, and they see leaders that they can follow. And so we need to mimic that across other areas of the company and tech and product and things like that so that we can kind of repeat the same thing. And to close out, I think inclusion, right? So we want to measure how people are feeling by doing these engagement surveys. And also it's good to see how people feel about the leadership commitments to, you know, commitment to DEI. How do they feel about the company? How do they feel about the leaders? Are they talking the talk or are they actually, you know, doing it?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, you touched upon a lot of the kind of points that I was thinking of, you know, kind of compensation, growth, retention, like where are people going, right? Tracking their reasons during exit interviews, understanding like what their career progression or journey was. And that can be very specific to certain departments or team managers, right? Like which managers are actually fostering an inclusive environment? And what's going on with these pockets of your organization where the experiences are so different than what you're seeing overall? And then kind of on that belonging or inclusion aspect, it's kind of intangible, right? Like it's a lot harder to measure that versus like compensation and pay raises, but it's really important. So definitely in terms of your engagement surveys, that's having really targeted questions there. And you can maybe segment these scores by demographic or experience group. You can also sort of collect more detailed qualitative data on experiences if you have a free text field for those who want to share. So those are ways that you can start asking these questions and hopefully in a way that isn't sort of is just really safe for employees to think about would be great. But it is hard. It's a lot harder kind of thinking about how do I track belonging and inclusion versus some of these like very straightforward metrics that are also super important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the acquiring of qualitative experiences is critical because that's your DEI brand. Essentially, that's what people want to know. You know, we can look at the numbers and people can say, that's great. Sure. We can definitely say we have a, you know, great, you know, number of employees that are being hired into the organization. We have a great number of them that are in leadership roles. We can be doing programs left and right. But if the experience is not going well for individuals of historically marginalized identities, if their experiences are not being validated, and that's what the language and the narrative that's being portrayed, then people won't want to come and be a part of that brand. Because it's important for organizations to understand that the stories do matter, the experiences do matter. And so with that in mind, you know, as we're talking about organizations growing and organizations being able to track and have these metrics at play, how do you suggest an organization move from a culture fit to a culture add approach in DEI? Marissa, do you have any thoughts?
I have lots of thoughts on culture fit versus culture ad. So first off, I think it's really important to understand the difference, right, between culture fit and culture ad. Culture fit is often used by organizations to really talk about how it kind of aligns with their existing values and culture. And organizations often have a tendency to hire people who are similar to them or who will just kind of fit in and feel at home easily. This doesn't work if you're trying to build a diverse and inclusive organization because it really implies that you want people to fit in the first place. And it also implies that some candidates won't fit in, right? So culture fit is more likely to lead to a more homogenous organization that just doesn't have the diversity that people keep trying to build. Instead, you know, you really want to think about culture ad. Culture ad really focuses on the new perspectives and experiences someone can bring to the table and kind of how they positively impact your existing team. So it focuses on sort of like the values alignment perspective, and it champions diversity as a strength. So if you think about it from that perspective, if you want to move from to a perspective of culture ad, you really need to move beyond the idea of using fit as a predictor for employee success. So you can think about a lot of different ways an individual can be successful at your company beyond just kind of fitting into your existing culture. Think about what success looks like and the many different paths that could take, right? And think about how that can shape and grow your culture into something new, or you know, it could be a lot more exciting or even much better than where it is now. So I always get a little bit nervous when people are talking about culture fit and going into this whole kind of sort of differentiation, but it's huge. It's like really changing the mindset and how you're really kind of thinking about it, not across just like hiring, but like how you even view your existing employees and what kind of culture ad each individual brings to, you know, a team that maybe was a founding team and how you want to grow that.
That is awesome indeed. That is awesome indeed. Culture ad is what we desire, not the fit, right? Let's just make it plain. Culture ad is what we want, not the fit. Awesome. So with that being said, you know, and we're getting to the home stretch of our time together. What are some ideas, right, that we can use in order to implement in our strategy, in our DEI strategy? What are some ideas that we can implement from a hiring, sourcing, closing, et cetera, perspective, as well as a company culture with its sense of inclusion and belonging, retention, et cetera? Seema, you want to go first and then Marissa?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think one of the most important strategies is, you know, focusing on making sure you get it right from the top. I mean, helping kind of senior leadership understand, you know, what their why is and transition from that checklist view of DEI to a cultural and empowering point of view. I've worked with quite a few executives on this, and first and foremost, I think it's important to understand, you know, what their privilege is, and then focus on using that privilege to help others. And the only way that you can really do that is if you can be vulnerable yourself and understand what exclusion feels like, because oftentimes many of these people have not felt that way. And if you're asking people to hire for a culture ad, you're asking them to come out of their comfort zone. And this is the same thing, essentially. Like they're doing something, they're trying to understand something that they've never experienced before. So they're completely out of their comfort zone. And this is the only way that they're going to build that safety, because you have to understand what underrepresented groups are experiencing in the workplace. I think it's important to have conversations with your employees, collect data, you know, really connect with people as human beings and acknowledge their pain. Essentially, you know, leading with empathy and compassion is key. I've also engaged with a firm called Leverage to Lead for several years, and they work with leaders because their approach is that, you know, leaders essentially know everything, right? Or they're the experts in everything that they do. But this is the one thing, like their cultural competency is not strong in DEI. So the goal for them has been working to kind of build that conscious competence around equity and inclusion issues. When you have this from the top trickling down, I think that that's where you truly build like a strong strategy. You truly kind of have leaders examine their power and their socialization, as well as build the inner agility to navigate that bias that Marissa was mentioning when you're doing the culture fit versus culture ad, and really kind of embrace the discomfort. And I think if you do that, it makes things easier when you're building that strategy.
I love the embrace the discomfort part, because a lot of this is super uncomfortable, right? Especially if someone is from a place of privilege, and to kind of have that, you know, you might feel guilt, or you might just really not understand you understand it conceptually, but you've never experienced it firsthand. And so there's a lot around that. From a hiring perspective, since I do focus on that quite a bit and helping our companies, we really talk about providing opportunities, right? Looking in the same places means that, you know, some candidates are never given that chance to apply, or they're ruled out due to some unconscious biases at an early stage. So really thinking about like, how can we provide extra opportunities for underrepresented minority groups to get into the interview room? That means you have to think about like kind of where you advertise jobs, how long jobs are open for, you know, how you actively seek out candidates. You can also include, like some people have done this and it works quite well. You can include an email address on your website or kind of jobs page just for folks from underrepresented minority groups to get in touch with you directly. And if you feel confident, answering questions about the role, helping out, that's a really nice thing just to say like, hey, you know, we want you to apply, please apply. And just kind of being really thoughtful about that, because it can be very scary, right? To kind of think like, oh, I haven't worked in this field before. I haven't worked in tech. Like it's all about kind of access and democratizing access to opportunities. So that's huge. There's definitely things around reducing hiring bias that, you know, we've experimented with in the past and would love to hear sort of from Greg and Seema kind of what you think about that. But, you know, there's a lot of, cool apps that you can remove identifying demographic data, or you can remove, you know, information like colleges or previous employment. And that's hard because sometimes if it removes too much, you like can't see anything. But even simply like removing someone's name, right? We've seen tons of studies that show a lot of biases, even towards names that are of associated with a particular gender or a racial identity sometimes. So there's a lot around that as well. Also just kind of making sure you are thoughtful in your job descriptions. Think about how language and skills requirements play a role. If your role requires a degree from a top college, then you're basically ensuring some candidates without that education level or from a specific socioeconomic background self-select out. So really think about how to be more skills focused and education agnostic, unless it's really critical to the role, which I actually find like 9 times out of 10, it is absolutely not. Like, unless it's like we need a forklift driver who has like taken, you know, has a certification, like that makes sense. But most of the time it's like, I want to know what you've done in the past, or like, what can your skills be applicable to other things? So there's a lot of, there's some gender decoding tools like Gender Decoder and Textio help with job descriptions, but that's more gendered, language. It really helps if like you can get folks to kind of read over and think about, okay, if I'm going to apply for this job, would I apply? And some people who are super qualified, even at your company right now, probably would be like, I'm not qualified for this job. And so being realistic about that as well.
Wow, that was awesome. That was awesome. I just love this part, these conversations, because we get so much insight and so much nuggets that we can just take with ourselves and learn from. And one of the things I want to highlight that was mentioned periodically from both of you was really the leadership understanding your why. And I think when leadership takes it upon themselves to be active agents, active participants in this, that's where the culture begins to shift. Because oftentimes we have a tendency of putting together a random committee with people who have never done this work, barely have a passion for it, and we never get off the ground. And the leadership says, well, we had an action council. We had a diversity action council. We had this diversity working group. They're the ones who dropped the ball. No, it was leadership who dropped the ball. Let's call a spade a spade. It was leadership that dropped the ball. And I think it's important that when leadership gets behind it, that's where change happens. Because as the reality will have it, DEI is something that we all strive to attain, really having an environment of inclusion, of belonging. It is a goal that we all have in mind, but we can never forget that it's also a process. It is something that we must perpetually continue to work at, to work on, to work with each other in order for us to create and develop a strategy that is actionable, scalable, as well as something that is practical and is actually being fulfilled. It's one thing to have a strategy. It's another thing to be living it out. And so for those of us who have been listening on today, we touched on a lot of things. I hope that you all learned something. I hope that you all got some nuggets from it. Listen, hey, Marissa, Seema, how can people get in contact with you right after this podcast? How can they reach out to you and maybe want to learn more about what you have going on, what you're doing in your work? How can they do so? Marissa, then Seema?
They can email me directly, marissa@playground.global. I'm terrible with LinkedIn, so sometimes I go through that once a month. So please email me instead.
That's funny, Marissa, because I was going to say, I'm actually really good with LinkedIn Connect. I'm actually worse with emails. So absolutely contact me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to have a chat and discuss more. I often talk to people who are building their strategies that they're when they're at smaller companies. So happy to connect.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for joining. For those of you listening on the podcast, their emails, their contact information will be posted in our description. But until then, we'll see you all next time. Take care.
You have been listening to the podcast, Building an Authentic and Scalable DEI Strategy. If you have not already, please take advantage of the resources in the podcast description. They are there for your benefit. Thank you all for tuning in. Until next time, bye.